Hello, listeners. This podcast is hosted by International Idea. In the next minutes, we will help you make sense of what's happening today in democracy worldwide.
Welcome to Democracy Ideas, the podcast on all things connected to the state and the future of democracy in the world. My name is Kevin Casasamora. I'm the Secretary General of International Idea, the Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance. Climate change is the defining challenge of our time. Although this crisis has been long in the making, the speed of this human-made disaster has accelerated dramatically over the past two or three decades. At this point, humanity is faced with a crisis in the original Greek sense of the word, a moment of separation, a turning point. Despite the hopes engendered by the Paris Agreement on climate change of 2015, now rekindled by the swift decision of a new administration in the United States to rejoin this global framework, the fact of the matter is that the world is extremely unlikely to meet the objective of limiting global warming to plus 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. Even worse, our planet is fast approaching a situation in which the equilibria that allowed for life and human civilization to emerge may be irretrievably altered, with consequences too severe and complex to imagine. Despite the magnitude of the challenge, mobilizing political will to act decisively has proven to be extremely difficult. Politics, to some extent, holds the key to effective action to confront the climate crisis. Yet, somewhat to my surprise, the political implications of climate change remain, to this day, relatively unexplored. And this is particularly true about the implications for democracy and human rights, two crowning achievements of our species that stand to be deeply affected by the environmental unraveling that is fast coming at us. This is what today's conversation is about. I would like to explore some of the potential consequences of the climate crisis in terms of exacerbating political frictions internationally as much as domestically. But also, I would like to talk a bit about how better to equip democratic systems to deal with climate change, lest we give up on them and on the fundamental rights that they protect as dispensable luxuries in the face of an existential emergency. To talk about this and to try and connect some of these scattered dots, I have the great pleasure of welcoming Andrew Gilmore, the CEO of the Berghof Foundation, a non-governmental organization based in Germany that supports people in conflict and peace-building efforts in a variety of places around the world, from the Balkans to the Caucasus, the Middle East, and sub-Saharan Africa. Before his current position, Andrew had a long and distinguished career at the United Nations, serving as Director for Political, Peacekeeping, Humanitarian, and Human Rights Affairs in the Executive Office of the Secretary General from 2012 to 2016, and eventually as UN Assistant Secretary General for Human Rights until 2019. But Andrew knows about more than high politics, conflict, and human rights. I read somewhere that he's also a lifelong passionate advocate for the environment, who at age 10 signed up to join the World Wildlife Fund. When I was 10, I was raising hell with my neighborhood friends and playing soccer. I was not nearly as serious and judicious as Andrew. Be that as it may, it's great to have you here, Andrew. Welcome to the podcast. And let me start by asking you, why is it that a democracy and peace-building organizations like International IDEA and the Berghof Foundation primarily work on democracy, peace-building, conflict prevention? Why should they care about climate change?
Thank you so much for having me, Kevin. It's a great pleasure. And I think, well, the answer to your question is that, as you rightly said, climate change is the defining problem and indeed phenomenon of our era, and so it affects every single aspect of our lives. And whether you're dealing with the economy, whether you're dealing with peace and security, or whether you're dealing with democracy issues or human rights, it affects all of them. And I'm afraid to say none of them for the better. So let us take the issues that we're involved in. First of all, conflict. I think it is increasingly understood, not necessarily in a very wide group so far, but it's still increasingly understood that conflict is gravely exacerbated by climate change. So much so that I would say that almost every conflict in the world is, to some extent, has as an additional driver now has climate change. Now, of course, there are many conflicts that long predate, for example, the Palestinian-Israeli one. Nobody in 1948 was talking about climate change. But if you look at that situation there now, you will find that even if there was momentum for a peace agreement there, an additional complication now would be the aquifers, the depleted aquifers in both Gaza and the West Bank, which would make things so much harder. But in every other conflict, I think it's not a coincidence that some of the most extremist and violent organizations in the world, whether we're talking Boko Haram in the Lake Chad Basin, or Al-Shabaab in Somalia, or Al-Qaeda in Yemen, or the Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, those four areas that I've just mentioned are among the regions of the world that are most affected, the most dramatically affected by climate change. So, and I think this is just a foretaste of what is going to come unless we take action very, very fast. So we are finding that all over the place, conflict, and to take Somalia that I mentioned, there you find that almost on a regular basis, there is a drought. And then there are also flash floods. And at the end of all of these, there's always a rise in recruitment for Al-Shabaab and the violent extremists. And the people on the ground don't necessarily see it as part of a global phenomenon. They live this experience, but they haven't yet been informed adequately about the global phenomenon. And therefore, it is definitely just a contributory cause that makes it that much harder for peace builders to understand, to come together, to get warring factions or warring clans or just people who have grave distrust for one another, to get them together. So that is why the peace builders need to come together. And for democracy, of course, and that's more your field, Kevin, and IDEA being perhaps the world's premier organization in the field of electoral assistance and democratization, you are on the front line of this particular struggle. And you will see how, and you will have seen in so many places, that there are additional threats to democracy that will come as the state of emergency that increasingly people will be forced to live under. And we know that in every state of emergency, human rights suffer. And so I think that is something you are clearly working very much on.
It's very interesting that you say that, because you published an article in Bloomberg several months ago, actually, interestingly, just as the pandemic was getting underway, in which you mentioned that preventing climate change should be seen as a human rights issue as much as a climate change issue. And I think that article proved prescient in light of what we've seen over the past few months, in the context of the current emergency. So can you elaborate a little bit on this notion that we should see a climate change also through the lens of human rights and the damage that it can cause to fundamental rights?
Yes. Well, I think that climate change poses a mammoth challenge to human rights in two very different ways. The first is the fact that, as the current High Commissioner for Human Rights, Michelle Bachelet, has said, it is the worst ever threat to human rights. Now, that may sound like hyperbole or exaggeration, but I don't believe it is, because when you look at human rights as covering the whole spectrum of human rights, which is what one should do, economic and social ones, one can see that climate change poses an existential threat to the rights to life, of course, rights to health, rights to work, rights to education, rights to working environment, all of these things. And when you see the rising temperatures, the rising sea levels, the extreme weather conditions, and the drought, I truly believe that the human rights implications are of a scale that we may not have seen anywhere in the world since 1945. So that is one level. Now, the other level is a little bit more indirect. And that is that while I think you and I would both regret that most world leaders don't take climate change seriously enough, there will be a time, it'll be too late, or, I mean, it'll be later than we would like, there will be a time when they do live up to their responsibilities. But my fear at that point is that they will respond by declaring a state of emergency, not that dissimilar, by the way, to what we have seen during part of the COVID response, but actually more extreme. And what we know from history is that whenever a country declares a state of emergency, it puts human rights on the back burner. We saw that at the start of the Second World War in the United States, when people of Asian origin were rounded up, or in my country, the United Kingdom, where people with German names were imprisoned. We saw the terrible torture that was carried out by the United States during the start of the Iraq War. Oh, so we know from time and again that states of emergency lead to human rights abuses. And this is what I think will happen when countries belatedly wake up to the threat of climate change.
This is really very, very interesting. I mean, my impression, I would like you to comment a little bit on this. I mean, is that it just generally speaking, uncertainty when social uncertainty levels spike, there's a very human tendency to rally around authoritarian figures and to acquiesce to things like states of emergency. And my impression is that climate change is a huge driver of uncertainty for all societies. And I guess, you know, that drives me to the leads me to the next question. I mean, what makes climate change different as a driver of conflict than other factors? I mean, this is the stuff you work on a daily basis when you work on peace building. I mean, what makes climate change different from other drivers of conflict?
Oh, I'm not sure it's necessarily different. It's certainly new. And the people in who have been working in conflict and climate all their lives are finding that they have to come up with a new series of areas of expertise to build up, and new concerns to handle, and new methods of conflict resolution. But I suppose what makes it different is that it is incurable. I mean, most other issues are, in the end, human issues one can resolve. They may take far too long. They may take decades. Oh, I've already mentioned the Arab-Israeli dispute. We have seen that, but which has lasted, I mean, three quarters of a century. But there are, if climate change, which I think it is going to be increasingly a driver of conflict as people under pressure are driven to take up weapons against one another, there really isn't going to be much cure for this one. So I don't really see how those working to resolve conflict and transform it into nonviolence are going to be able to do that job very well.
Tell me a little bit about the work that Berghof, the Berghof Foundation, is doing. And just to go to a more granular level, I mean, how is climate change affecting the work of your organization, being an organization that works on peace building and conflict prevention? I mean, give me some concrete examples in terms of the projects that you guys have on the way in a variety of places. How much are you encountering already the consequences of the frictions created by a climate change?
Well, as I said, it's new, and it's new for us too. This year is the 50th anniversary of the Bogart Foundation, but until last year, we hadn't really done very much on that issue of climate change. We have focused on so many other drivers of conflict, but we've realized that it is unavoidable and that one has to address these matters. And we can absolutely see where they are very much a problem. I mean, we see that with intentions between Ethiopia and Egypt over a dam for the Nile River. We see it in problems in Somalia, in many areas, whether it's a question of charcoal production and the deforestation that is a result of the charcoal industry. What we're trying to do now, I mean, and in fact, just this week, we have a meeting to look, a public meeting to look at three countries specifically, Afghanistan, Syria, and Ethiopia, which are countries we're very interested in. And we're getting experts from both the climate community, the environmentalist community, but also the peace and security community to come together, because frankly, neither community fully takes into account the concerns of the other. And that is the first thing we need to do before we can come up with specific measures for what to do in any given particular country. There is a more widespread agreement within our world, our small world of people working full time on these issues, that there is a direct link between climate change and conflict that gets worse. But at the moment, it's still the early days, and we haven't yet decided as a community what exactly needs to be done in Syria, for example, in Iraq, in Nicaragua, or in any country that we're involved in where we might try to make things better, but realize that our work is complicated by climate change as a factor.
And I'm just wondering, I mean, let's look at this from a slightly different angle. I mean, we know, and the Bertho Foundation itself has done work on this. You've mentioned that climate change is exacerbating conflict, and that part is pretty well established. I mean, what is less clear is how does it affect peace building efforts? I mean, we know that it exacerbates conflict. I mean, in which ways it obstructs, it hampers peace-building efforts of the kind that the Bertho Foundation is engaged in a lot of places?
When you bring in climate change not as the root cause, but as a contributory factor, it, of course, makes it that much harder to resolve the issues that are what people are fighting about. When it comes to peace-building, though, what I am particularly keen to see is not merely that it is a complicating factor and that it makes our work harder, but to see where peace-building tools could actually be aided by a greater reliance on climate issues. For example, if we could get two warring parties in whatever country to understand that the problem that they are facing isn't just because they can't bear their rivals who live in the next door region and a rival clan, but actually their problems are related to something that it's not the fault of anybody living there. But similarly, there could be some form of solution that you could get them together. For example, if you could get warring sides to realize that there could be a peace dividend by investing, let's say, in a massive new forestry reforestation project, or a renewable energy, solar power or wind or water, and to understand that somehow, if they can come together, the international community will almost reward them for that which would very much be in the self-interest of the international community to do, not only from the point of view of peace and security and everything that that leads to, migration and insecurity, but also from a point of view of mitigating the disaster of climate change. So if one could get the warring sides also to understand, though, that peace mediators and peace builders aren't the same people as are the big investors. So one needs to get the big investors, whether you're talking about the World Bank and the regional development banks, or whether you're talking about the private sector, to get involved with peace builders, to work together, to allow the warring sides to understand that taking action on climate could be mutually beneficial.
Being at the UN for quite a long time, I suppose, offers you a very good vantage point to appreciate the impact that good governance has to prevent conflict. Generally speaking, one can say that democracy and good governance do have a positive impact in preventing conflict. So my question now is, what role do you think democracy and good governance, from what you've seen, may have in the prevention of climate change, or rather in the mitigation of climate change?
Well, one thing I came in increasingly to recognize, Kevin, was that although people like you and I would talk about democracy and good governance as if they are almost linked, what is interesting is that you might find very senior Chinese officials, for example, who are very explicit as to say the two things are nothing whatever to do with one another. And they have, I've had this discussion with them, and it was remarkable to me how they will portray good governance as almost being the antithesis of democracy. And they have explicitly said in a big meeting, by the way, not an open meeting, but a very large one with some of the most senior officials of the UN anywhere in the world, they pointed out that this democracy that people like you are so keen of, do you think we Chinese would ever do anything as stupid as elect an idiot like Trump, or to do something as so monumentally self-destructive as Brexit? They understood from my accent because I'd asked a question about human rights, which they didn't like. So they responded with that point, and fair enough. So they said, it's not about democracy. It's about good governance. And this is what we have. And for example, they use climate as a way to demonstrate that by saying, look, we have a leader who's looking forward to 2050. You Americans, have a leader, Trump, looking back to 1950 and in love with coal and old technologies such as that. So I do think this is an extraordinarily important point, because it puts the democracy, which frankly we have seen even in the last few weeks, with the 6th of January being a date that will live in infamy for many people, quite what a narrow, slender thread democracy hangs by. And this has clearly not been lost on the Chinese. And I think that it means all the more that those people who want to defend democracy, as we of course do, have to be that much more careful to show that we are effective. And what we've just seen in the last few days in Texas, for example, is a salutary lesson to us that people who are elected in a democracy can do incredibly stupid things that discredit democracy. And Ted Cruz, who is no friend of efforts to stop climate change at all, but still fled his state and discredited his entire discredited democracy within the eyes of many of his constituents. And that is just one very recent example. I think there are many others, because it is also the case, we were talking earlier about the links between human rights and climate change. I do not think it's a coincidence that many of the world leaders who are most hostile to the environment and are the biggest climate change deniers are also enemies of human rights in a very major way. And to take the largest country of the Latin American region, Brazil, obviously that would be a very high example of that. And the United States under Trump would be another. But there are many others too. That does not apply to China. China is, I think we can also say, is not a friend of human rights. But on climate change, they are more far-sighted than many other people. And I think they will use that point to further help discredit the cause of democracy in those countries where it's already a little bit fragile.
That much is true, and that's a legitimate discussion to have. I mean, I always find that kind of argument a little bit simplistic, because, you know, for every authoritarian system that provides evidence of good governance, there are 10 authoritarian systems that, you know, when you have an authoritarian system, you might be lucky and end up with Lee Kuan Yew, but you might not be so lucky and end up with Idi Amin, right? So my question is, in your experience, you know, having this discussion in the context of the of dealing with climate change, do you see any positive examples where democracies have been able to take effective action? And just generally, what do you think are the strengths that democratic governance, and here I'm talking specifically about democratic governance, bring to this discussion?
Yes, I just to clarify, what I was saying before was not my point of view.
Of course. Right.
And I've spent my entire life, my entire UN career, 30
absolutely.
Years of it, pushing the case that democracy is better in terms of...
No, I'm asking
prevention.
You this precisely.
I know, I'm not thinking, but I'm saying, but let us also be aware that there have been developments this year which have weakened our case, and COVID has been an example of that. The United States, and indeed, I'm afraid, the United Kingdom, have not distinguished themselves in their handling of the crisis at any stage until, in the case of the UK, the very rapid distribution of vaccinations. But until last month, there was not a good record. And the fact that China, which is almost certainly where the virus originated from, has nevertheless managed to keep a lid on it more effectively than many democracies is an argument that is not going to play well for democracies, although I totally agree. There are also democracies like New Zealand that have handled it far better than anybody. But so that's a very important point. I think climate change absolutely has to be done with the will of the people involved. Otherwise, they will find ways to undermine it. And we see that, at many levels. If a region, obviously, that you know vastly more about than I do, one does find that indigenous communities in various parts of the world oppose renewable energy projects, not because they are remotely against renewable energy as a concept, but merely because in some cases, projects are imposed on them in their communities, in their historic ancestral lands, without adequate consultation, so they do not feel ownership of it, and therefore, as has always been the case with them, whether it's extractive industries or tourism or whatever, and they have not been adequately consulted, and as a result, they have opposed it. So I do believe that if you don't have a system that adequately consults and educates its population as to the necessity of taking very serious action for climate change, then this is going to be a problem. I still fear that the enormity of this challenge means that public opinion will not be as quick on it as it should be, so therefore there will be, regrettably, and I mean deeply regrettably, measures will be taken even by democracies that fall short of high human rights or democratic standards. But, and I think we should just do what we can to mitigate that threat.
That's a you're this is a, an interesting segue into a into my next question, which is one issue that I find particularly intractable. In theory, one can find a myriad good traits about democracy that could help with in dealing with the climate crisis, including the ability for civil society to organize and to voice a pressure and to voice demands and to put pressure on political systems. The really tricky problem is that we have very little time left before this crisis reaches a tipping point. So you've been a very strong advocate of creating links between pro-human rights groups and groups that are deeply involved in the struggle against climate change. So my question to you is, are you hopeful that even if we succeed in creating those links and enabling this cross-fertilization, would that happen fast enough to mobilize democratic systems to take the action that needs to be taken to deal effectively with the crisis that we are facing?
Yes, it's going to take an enormous effort, but I think I am quite optimistic. If you look historically, unfortunately, and it shouldn't be the case, environmental movements, and I'm speaking more broadly than just climate change now, environmental movements and human rights movements have not collaborated very much. And indeed, some of the earliest conservation measures, the setting up of the great national parks in the United States in the 19th century, for example, were taken at a cost of terrible human rights violations. For example, the mass expulsion of the Native American population from Yellowstone and Yosemite. These were conservation measures, by the way. We've moved well beyond that, and in many cases you do find environmentalists working much more closely with the human rights organizations. And I was happy to see that Amnesty, the arguably the world's leading human rights organization, has certainly embraced this in a major way, and Human Rights Watch too, and many others on the ground. But there's still a long way to go. And this is something that I'm very keen to contribute to improve dialogue between those groups, to understand that not only, as I mentioned before, do they share the same enemies. It's the climate change deniers and those who are not in favor of human rights are often the same people, supported by the same media figures such as Murdoch or the big oil and big energy, who don't seem to be really very much in favor either of human rights or of the environment, but to understand the rest of us that we need to come together, and only if we do that is there really much hope for either. But there have been encouraging steps in this regard, and there is much more dialogue than there was even 5 years ago. So I'm optimistic, but a lot more has to be done.
Let me finish up with a question. Again about democracy, and I, as you said a minute ago, you've been committed to democracy and human rights always, and you've engaged in this discussion with the Chinese officials and so on and so forth about the relative merits of democracy in terms of its ability to deal with climate change and other crises. If they gave you a magic wand to change something in democratic systems that would enable them to be more effective in dealing with this kind of challenge, a challenge that is acute, that is intergenerational, that is, with massive implications in the long term, they gave you that magic wand. Tell me one thing that you would try to reform.
Well, just before I left the UN, which was only about 16 months ago, I think my last overseas trip was to your country, which, for anyone who doesn't know listening to this, is Costa Rica. And it was a pre-COP meeting, and I spoke to a lot of youth delegations from a number of, mainly Latin American, but not only, countries. And I asked them all the same question. And to my great surprise, I got the same answer from almost all of them. They all said, what we need in my country, whatever their country was, is more human rights education and more climate change education. And that is, I think, everything that we're seeking, Kevin, is predicated on that. If people don't know about human rights, they're not going to know what they are entitled to stand up for themselves, let alone do on behalf of others. And if they don't know that, then they're also not going to be able to, if they don't know the extent of the climate change disaster and what measures are possible, then that too is going to prevent them putting up the great fight that is necessary. And that means taking on, and it means having the power and the information to take on the big energy companies that have brutally suppressed all information until very recently about the impact of their energy production on climate change, and the big media companies, again, as I will say, Murdoch's companies, that have done so much to sneer at people who have called out the alarm on climate change. So I think that would be my magic wand, is to have a much more effective form of communication and education. We have just seen, and we are continuing to see in the United States, the desperate effect of systematic, cynical disinformation, so that you get, I just read this morning, 75% of Republican voters genuinely believe that the election was stolen and that the results were rigged. I mean, with that level of uneducation, or rather disinformation, in the end, it doesn't really matter which it is. It's certainly lack of education based on cynical disinformation. But until you have that, then we can't really deal with either the human rights education or the climate change education, which we are so going to need to support your great cause, which is to strengthen democracy and electoral processes, and indeed my cause, which is to try to resolve conflict and move it away from violence.
This is very interesting, Andrew, and I would just only add that in your answer, there's also, in a way, implied that it might be worth using that magic wand to involve in a more active way young people into the decision-making process. So that in itself might go a long way towards dealing with all this multifold crisis that we are faced with. Andrew, it's been an enormous pleasure. I've learned a lot, and I certainly hope that we'll continue this conversation going forward. In our case, I mean, this is, as I mentioned to you at some point, this is merely the start of a work stream that we want to take forward. I do think that the connection between democracy and climate change has been underexplored, and that we might have something to contribute to the discussion. And we're trying to contribute by, for starters, by having discussions such as this one. So thank you so much for making the time and for being part of this effort, which is an education effort, by the way. So I certainly hope to see more of you in the future. And all the best with your endeavors at Berghof.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. And thank you all, and I hope that you will keep on following our podcast and our discussions on all things connected to the state and the future of democracy. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to the Democracy Ideas podcast. Keep following International IDEA on social media. We need all of you to participate in constructing better societies. Goodbye.